fact, for a topic, there's nothing to bring people out like Valentine's. Bunte, how do I get that good date? Well, I'm going to let you in on a little secret about love at first sight. Now, I'm going to read this out, and I'm going to read this story out in the third person because it's about myself. Obviously not as a monk, right? But I'm going to read this one out into about my life prior to this and my experience of love at first sight. And we've got some flowers as well to make it all that much more special. You can't have Valentine's without flowers, right? Guys, yes, you need flowers for Valentine's. Today is Valentine's Day, guys. Yeah, ladies, you probably haven't reminded him yet. And if it's going to be later this evening, forget about it. Guys, just go watch football or something. Nothing's going to happen. All right, so let's make a start on the topic of love at first sight. So in order for this to work, instead of just speaking ad lib, I'm going to be reading this. Normally I just talk ad lib, but this one I'm going to be reading this out because it's important to maintain the high fidelity of the historical events. In order to convey the full sense of the subject at hand, so without further delay. This love story started in a university in Queensland. It was a university situated by a large hybridized environment, a blend of city and country, where people were fairly relaxed and didn't do anything too quickly. This kind of university suited John. That was my name before being a monk. This university suited John best as he tended to err on the lazy side of student life. Some of the time spent at the university cafe solving the problems of the world, some of his time playing bass guitar in a folk band, and a little time at the uni bar, claiming his right to cheaper alcohol on happy hour days, as is every student's right. But it wasn't in these areas that John's interests were piqued. There are two main areas where John would find, and did find, something of much greater interest than liquid amber or hyperactive caffeinated conversations with beret-wearing try-hard philosophers. One of these areas would be out at the student accommodation areas on one of the three colleges at this uni. John was fortunate enough, or unfortunate, depending on how you might value privacy, to live in university accommodations. In other words, college, in the Australian sense of the word. It was very convenient to live just across the campus, and John knew that it also had a highly disproportionate ratio of young female to male residents. Just the ticket for any hot-blooded young man with the delusion of having stacks of time on his side. At that time, John didn't really appreciate the kind of heart-changing experience he was about to have. It was a day like any other for this jaded, and some might say skeptical, arts student. John was sitting in a small lecture hall to endure, for what most students present, another droll excursion through academia in order to walk out of the institution with an arts degree. Now, it just so happened that there were plenty of things that one could distract themselves with during a lecture. More often than not, John would scrutinize all who entered the classroom on any given day. Typically, he would be looking for people who were late, so he could just mentally call them all sorts of names for disrupting the class. John found some satisfaction in seeing the half-dead student zombies shuffling into the room late with people staring at them, either through abject boredom of the unit of study being presented, or the fact that the person dared to be late and has poor fashion sense. For these hapless students, they got the double barrel of being avoided due to being a fashion nightmare, and avoided because they probably suck at group assignment work. The logic being, if they habitually turn up late to a lecture, they were likely to hand in an assignment late as well. For when that happens to them, that's their assignment, it's all well and good. But when they are part of a group handing in a group assessment, this was a disaster to be avoided. This meant that they were to be avoided. John knew this, and as a result, was somebody who kept an eagle eye on those who were late, those who didn't turn up regularly, and those who looked as if the tying of their own shoelaces was an intractable situation akin to solving world hunger. It was with such an eagle eye that John surveyed the world, and it of course It was a pleasant and a great surprise if the object in front of him was pleasant to behold rather than unpleasant. Let's face it, who wants to look at anything unpleasant? So on this day, during class, John was struck down with something pleasant for a change, and it was a feeling that went straight to his heart. This was not just any average encounter that we are talking about here. This was a case of love at first sight. Now, something you probably don't know about John is that he was somewhat introverted when it comes to striking up connections. He wasn't known for bravery on this front. When we are talking about love at first sight, it's all about the heart leaping outward, almost as if there is a wild elephant rampaging through small shrubs. Nothing can really stand in its way. So too, that heart jumps, it leaps out of the chest at the mere sight of that which it loves, that which consumes its thoughts by day and by night. For this is one of the hallmarks of love at first sight. John knew that this was unique, for he didn't have this kind of feeling before. There was a sense of knowing that here, right before his eyes, was an opportunity that just didn't come around every year, not even once before in his short span of 26 years on this planet. This was a golden opportunity, and surely he could find the courage to approach, to get closer, to get to know, to explore. But there was a problem. There was a lack of courage to get closer, to be more intimate with what was a stranger. How could John muster the courage to reach out and touch and experience more of this feeling? Surely, if the heart is so touched by mere sight, how would it be to have a much closer connection? Surely John was missing out, and John, even if a somewhat lazy university student, wasn't one who liked missing out on opportunities. After all, he kept an eye out for such things, and to those things that were obstacles to having more pleasant experiences. There is, however, a fine art to approaching your one true love. You cannot run like a bull from a rodeo gate. All you end up doing is bringing unwanted attention to yourself in this manner, and that is just not proper for someone who is shy in approaching in the first place. No, this requires more consideration, more of a tactical response. It's one thing for a collector to get the butterfly, another thing entirely to preserve it in pristine condition. If you value real love, you would not want anything bad to happen in your relationship. So how you start is very important, lest you scare that butterfly away with a brutish approach. Being in a semi-rural area meant that there were plenty of meatheads around, so you wouldn't want to emulate such a person, such a Luddite. For surely you would fail with that approach. You simply don't get this kind of opportunity every day, so you may not get more than one shot. Best to make it count. So after assessing the situation, John decided to commit to action. Love from a distance, after all, is not all that interesting. Actually, it's quite painful to see and not to hold when all one wants is intimacy, closeness. John knew that timing was important, and that making a move in the classroom was not the best place to develop a relationship. He thought of alternatives. How about the cafe? What about the pub? No, not these places, not really suitable. How about the movies? What about a fine restaurant? What about McDonald's? No, even though he was a student, John did know the difference between fine dining and McDonald's. Going through the drive-through did not constitute an excellent night out, even if this was the norm for students at this time. How about having some class? What about a nice quiet place? Somewhere where you don't need to scream in order to understand or be understood. John pondered where such a beautiful place might be. Now, it just so happens that there was a Japanese garden in the university grounds. It had all the right features to satisfy the requirements of promoting intimate connection. There were water features and tall, slender stalks of bamboo. There were park benches for, well, you know, comfort. There were bridges over lakes and water birds that lived on its banks. It was well manicured and attended on by gardeners who fussed over it with great care every day of the week. Surely, out of all the places John had thought of, This was by far the best place to make a bold move. And so, with much interest and an edge of excitement, John decided on making the bold move. The place was right, the time was right, and if left for too long, this opportunity could very well slip through his fingers. Up until that point, she didn't really have any idea about John. One would say she was kind of neutral about him. John wouldn't like to think she was indifferent towards him. John had made very subtle indications of interest without trying to be as obvious as a 13-year-old boy trying desperately to impress a girl in the schoolyard with handstands, shows of strength and other such displays, which are common in most males in the animal kingdom. John knew that just because he had certain feelings, that it wasn't necessarily true that they would be universally accepted or returned. This was in part the risk in any approach one makes within the context of relationships, in particular the quality of trust. One does need the faith, confidence and conviction to make that first contact and to carry it through. How many of us have made two or three steps only to withdraw four or five steps when we get too close? Surely this is fear of the unknown, and when John had his first encounter, she didn't flinch one bit. Indeed, it was a revelation to John that here he was, this 6'2", tall man, afraid of her, so delicate and refined by comparison with his bulk and roughness. The trepidation on starting out on this journey was embarrassing when one comes to think about it. But there was something more to this relationship that just wasn't there in any of John's previous relationships. There was an honesty that just couldn't be negotiated on, an honesty that had to flow in a two-way manner, from and towards. It was demanded in a way that was not threatening, but certainly uncomfortable in that it was the first time that John encountered delicacy and resoluteness, an immovable quality in all in the one stroke. It didn't matter in which way John approached her. She just did not compromise on certain things, and being full of the proverbial crap was just one of the things she wouldn't entertain. John, however, was quite skilled in the art of spinning out crap, but he didn't appreciate it all that much. She didn't appreciate it all that much, though in her defense, she was very gentle about it. She just wouldn't take it on and make it her burden. This was a quality I admired and still admire to this day. Of course, just because there was love at first sight doesn't mean everything about it was comfortable or familiar. On the contrary, whilst there was a connection, there was also a lot of mystery. There were many avenues in this relationship that required more thought, more investigation, a sense of wonder, and on many occasions bewilderment. And frustration. Oh yes, there was much frustration. For it is the case that in life you can form connections that don't make immediate sense or seem to hold great value. Sometimes you never get to understand certain aspects of the relationship. Of course, over time, the job of understanding these deeper connections can become easier, but it demands an honesty within yourself. John, unfortunately, at this stage, was not fully conversant with his own heart to the point of allowing that deeper connection, a task that would require much in the way of homework. Now, the intrigue and adventure was important for John in this relationship, for how many people seek out boring relationships and are satisfied with them. John plucked up the courage and approached her. She was immovable, very direct, but at the same time inviting. This seemed to contradict John's preconceived notions of her from a distance. Now was the time to make a bolder move. John sat down with her and started to open his heart to her. At first there was some resistance, not by her, but more from John. The honesty factor was the hardest part here, the willingness not to hide away or run away from her. It was apparent to John that nothing but bare truth would survive in this relationship, and she was not one who would budge on that point. She could seem sometimes to be quite cruel when it came to this, but it was something that was not negotiable. John had to be direct, honest, and aware of his traits. Traits and habits normally go into any relationship, and she knew this. She was, however, very gentle, very compassionate. Just looking at her directly with an open heart was like being bathed in sunlight from a break in the clouds on a cold winter's day. John told her his secrets, not that John could hide them from her anyway. What John thought about, and sometimes she would laugh with John, sometimes she would laugh at John. But this was only when he was trying to pull the wool over his own eyes. She never took him seriously when he acted in this way. John in time grew to love her even more, though he did struggle many times in the relationship. However, all things, including the best relationships, had to come to an end. One day, John realized that his relationship with her had actually changed. He realized that to not acknowledge this would actually hold him back in his life's journey. Keeping well in mind that she didn't tolerate lies or dishonesty, she knew John had evolved with her along the way, and that she, on one occasion, had come to know John very well, but on another, knew that there were limitations to his current way of life. She wanted John to move on with his life, to not hold himself back. She was very giving and selfless, and John knew he would never encounter anything, anywhere, at any time that could match her or surpass her. This relationship was not an ordinary one. She also knew this. John came to the crossroads of this relationship over a couple of years where he needed to make a decision. Would he move on and leave her behind completely, or would he make the most of the relationship, move forward and be a better person for it? John decided to move on and hopefully upwards. It was early in the morning on January 26th that John got up quietly and made preparations to leave. He didn't want to bother her, but she was not one to be easily fooled. She was very aware of what he was up to and wasn't going to be asleep as he left like a thief in the night. She helped him up to this point, and she figured that he needs a little more help to make the transition to monastery life. She did, after all, support John in this move without reservation. Indeed, she actively encouraged him. Where else would John find such support to do something that can change the nature of this very relationship? She was indeed selfless. At 2 a.m., John took his keys and started the car. He looked for what might be the last time upon his home, the university colleges where he had lived for 3 years. He started the engine and put the car into gear. She didn't flinch. She didn't resist his leaving. Instead, she had nothing but understanding and encouragement as he drove out of the driveway. She is stronger than any person John knew as he left that place for good. John eventually took up robes and joined the Sangha of monks. He thought of her during this time as a monk as he reflected back on his university years. She, of course, would never see John again as she knew him. She would only ever see him now as a monk, where naturally the nature of the relationship has changed. It might come as some surprise for people to know that she does keep up with Venerable Jag and keep tab on what he gets up to. One cannot have such a connection and cut everything completely off. Indeed, her presence has only enriched both John's and Venerable Jag's life. Actually, she is in this room right now, though many of you may not be familiar with her. Of course, she does have a name, and for the sake of prudence, I haven't mentioned it. But some of you might be curious as to who she is, and if you ever meet her, to inquire about the nature of love at first sight. So I'll tell you her name. Her name is the Dhamma. And this was the story of John's love of the Dhamma at first sight. That's it. Oh, yeah. You're all looking around, aren't you? Who is this woman? Where's she? Okay. Was that what you expected? No? Every blockbuster has to have a twist. Apparently, that's the rules. All right. So, love at first sight. The Buddha doesn't talk about love at first sight in the suttas. There's no reference to that in particular. But there are teachings in regards to a husband and wife who will approach the Buddha. So I'll read a little bit of the sutta out in regards to this particular situation. And you can see how the Buddha takes care of this or treats this particular subject. Okay, this is from the Anguttara Nikaya. It's from the Book of Fours. And it's number 55, The Same in Living. Number one. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Bhagas in Sumsumaragiri. No, I'll try that again. Sumsumaragira. Good Lord. That's why the Buddha says to learn the Dhamma in your own language. All right? I could say Brisbane. It wouldn't make a difference. In the deer park at Besakala Grove. Then in the morning, the Blessed One dressed, took his bowl and robe and went to the residences of the household Nakula Pitta, where he sat down in the prepared seat. Then the householder and the householder's wife approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and the householder said this to the Blessed One, Bhante, since I was young, when the young girl was given to me in marriage, I do not recall ever transgressing against her, even in thought, much less by deed. We wish, Bhante, to see one another not only in the present life, but also in future lives. The householder's wife in turn said to the Blessed One, Bhante, since I was a young girl given to the young householder in marriage, I do not recall ever transgressing against him, even in thought, much less by deed. We wish, Bhante, to see one another, not only in this present life, but also in future lives. Householders, if both husband and wife were to see one another, not only in this present life, but also in future lives, they should have the same faith, the same virtuous behavior, the same generosity, and the same wisdom. Then they will see one another, not only in the present life, but also in future lives. So that was the Blessed One's speech at that stage. Now it goes into poetry, usually not the Blessed One who puts this kind of thing in here. Both husband and wife are endowed with faith, charitable and self-controlled, living their lives righteously, addressing each other with pleasant words. Then many benefits accrue to them and they dwell at ease. Their enemies are saddened when both are the same in virtue. Having practiced the Dhamma here, the same in virtuous behavior and observances, delighting after death in a deva world, they rejoice enjoying sensual pleasures. So that's that sutta. So for those of you celebrating Valentine's Day with a loved one, wanting, thinking, oh, I would love nothing more than to meet my loved one again in future lives, over and over, like a movie called The Neverending Story. Some of you might be thinking like this if your relationship seems to be good. Some of you with suboptimal relationships think this is the worst advice ever. To be avoided, Bhante, what things do I not have to have? No faith, no same virtuous behavior, no generosity, and no same wisdom. Great, I can do that. Just to make sure I avoid this person in a future life. So sometimes people might actually get this confused with this actual teaching and the Buddha saying that the Buddha is actually encouraging for you to go from life to life hanging out with the same partner. He is not saying this at all, right? Not at all. And just to make sure that that is not the case, I've got the antidote. So this is sutta number 5 from the Anguttara Nikaya in the Book of Fours. It's called Along with the Stream. Monks, there are these four kinds of persons found existing in the world. What four? The person who goes along with the stream, the one who goes against the stream, the one who is inwardly firm, and the one who has crossed over and gone beyond, the Brahman who stands on the high ground. And what is the person who goes along with the stream? Here, someone indulges in sensual pleasures and performs bad deeds. This is called the person who goes along with the stream. And what is the person who goes against the stream? Here, someone does not indulge in sensual pleasures or perform bad deeds. Even with pain and dejection, weeping with a tearful face, he lives the complete and purified spiritual life. This is called the person who goes against the stream. And what is the person who is inwardly firm? Here, with utter destruction of the five lower fetters, some person is of spontaneous birth, due to attain final nibbana, there without ever returning from that world. This is called the person who is inwardly firm. And what is the one who has crossed over and gone beyond, the Brahman who stands on high ground? Here, with the destruction of the taints, some person has realized for himself, with direct knowledge, in this very life, the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, and having entered upon it, dwells in it. This is called the person who has crossed over and gone beyond, the Brahman who stands on high ground. These bhikkhus are the four kinds of persons found existing in the world, those people who are uncontrolled in sense pleasures, not rid of lust, enjoying sense pleasures here, repeatedly coming back to birth and old age, immersed in craving, are the ones who go along with the stream. Therefore, a wise person with mindfulness established, not resorting to sense pleasures and bad deeds, should give up sense pleasures even if it's painful. They call this person one who goes against the stream. One who has abandoned five defilements, a fulfilled... Okay, now we're going... That's the end of the Buddha's speech. Now we're going into poetry land. One who has abandoned five defilements, a fulfilled trainee, unable to retrogress, attained to mind's mastery, his faculties composed. This person is called one inwardly firm. One who has comprehended things high and low, burnt them up so they are gone and exist no more. That sage who has lived the spiritual life, reached the world's end, is called one who has gone beyond. The main hook between these two suttas was the term or the phrase sensual pleasures. So in the first one, where the husband and the wife approached the Buddha asking, what are the conditions for us to meet with each other in future lives? It was the sensual desire. It was the sensual pleasures, which was, especially in the poetry section, enjoying sensual pleasures in the other world. So this is the cause and this is the reason. But it's interesting that it's actually in the poetry side of things, you don't find that phrase in what the Buddha is actually saying. And he's actually advocating. They asked, this is the proposition, we would like to be together, and he tells them the way for that to happen. He's not saying, you should do this, you should make much of this. You know, he's not encouraging it in this way, but he's saying, okay, A plus B is going to equal C. You're after C, you need A and you need B. He's not saying you should develop A and B. All right? So clearly there's a contradiction between those two suttas if you're coming from the perspective that the Buddha is actually encouraging in the first one, a union between two people, and encouraging them to continue that union in future lives. For the Buddha gives a teaching in the very basic way, very basic fundamental teaching of the Buddha is one of impermanence. And another fundamental teaching is rooted in the concept birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, being with those who you don't like is suffering, listening to talks which go for too long is also suffering. Being fooled by the nature of the talk is also suffering, but that's because of your expectation. Okay. So the Buddha gives teachings about the nature of dissatisfaction in the world and how to avoid it. And the only way of avoiding that is the Four Noble Truths, understanding the Four Noble Truths. And how to arrive at that understanding is through fulfilling the factors of the Eightfold Path, establishing right view. When you start to establish right view, you put yourself onto that path of freedom. You haven't arrived yet until it is purified. That view is clear, crystal clear. Not a few bugs on the windscreen and a bit of dirt. It's not enough. It has to be so clean you're prepared to eat off it, right? Even cleaner. So that's what you need to do. If you want to enjoy the partnership and friendship of your partner in a future life, well, the Buddha's given you the instructions for that. All the ingredients are there. Same generosity and same wisdom. Even just doing those two things is very difficult. Getting two people to align just with those two things, same generosity, same wisdom. Oh, you could just leave it at one, it might be difficult, okay? So it's not exactly easy. But if both people in the partnership are actually committed to acts of generosity, they're actually committed to the development of wisdom in a very even kind of way, if that commitment is present, then you're fulfilling these factors. And that would lead to a relationship which is stable, right? If one's like a Liberal voter, the other's a Labor voter, well, that probably won't help too much maybe the views can be quite radical, okay? But if you're of a similar mind, you're both hippies, you both like the Greens, you both you love art galleries, and classical music, you like walks on the beach. It's not like one says, I want to watch football, the other one says, I want to go for a drive in the country. It's like, well, can I watch football as you're driving? It's that kind of, that doesn't work. But when you're closely aligned, then those factors are present, as the Buddha is mentioning here in this particular talk. And having that even yoke, a reference is made in the suttas, imagining if there's a horse and an ox, and you put a yoke, it's like the timber around their necks, in order for the cart to get pulled. But the horse and the ox have very different qualities. Yes, they both have four legs. Yes, they're both mammals. Right? Just like you can meet a person. Yes, they're a human being. Yes, they're the gender that you're interested in. But there's more to a relationship than just these basic factors. So when the horse is trying to pull the cart, it's pulling at a higher height, at a greater height than the ox that's lower to the ground. The ox is more stable because its center of gravity is lower. It is stronger in pulling. It is not fast, though. The horse can outrun the ox, but the ox can outpull the horse. So some relationships are like that. And you say, ah, I knew I married a horse. My husband is such an ox. It depends which one's the fast one in the relationship and which one's the strong one, you know. But sometimes both are horses. So if they're both horses, then they can pull a carriage. And, you know, like you see in period piece dramas, you don't see a horse with an elephant, a zebra and a giraffe pulling a carriage with Cinderella hopping out. You just drop by the zoo. What is this? So normally you see four horses, six horses, two horses. Even better is one horse. One horse is better than a horse and an ox. That's dysfunctional, right? And there are relationships which are like that, right? They're just plain dysfunctional. You know, you look at them and you're just going, how? Is there a contract? Is there a law that made you two get together somehow? I mean, how? And sometimes they work. Strangely, beyond all odds, these relationships work. But more often than not, they've got their difficulties, all right? And this is what the Buddha is also talking about here, is that shared vision, shared mentality, kind of a shared practice. Sometimes it's difficult if you're a serious Buddhist practitioner. You go to meditation retreats, you're at the monastery, you're meditating on your spare days, you're listening to Dhamma talks. Your husband doesn't do any of that. Your wife doesn't do any of that. It's very hard to kind of gel. They want to have a death metal playing session in their garage behind the house, and you're going, it doesn't sound like the, you know, the Dhammacakka Pavattana, the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma discourse, which is a little bit more gentle than death metal in many respects. So sometimes finding that commonality is not very easy. And love at first sight, you could just take the word love out, it's just lust. But what is it based on? This particular sutta here, when the Buddha is talking about how you get together in future lives, how is that possible? Shared views, shared wisdom, etc. By developing those things, then in a future life you might actually see a person who is like that. It's not really all that common, these kinds of experiences. I have had a real experience. I won't say it was love at first sight, but it was like this. It was an intensely interesting person. And this was at a pedestrian crossing of all places. I'm in a car, I stop for a pedestrian, she's walking across the pedestrian crossing, this is a true story, not as a monk, right? And she turns and she looks at me and she just gives the smile. And I was like, wow. And I kicked myself for not actually parking the car to go up and say hello to her. Now, she was in her 50s, I was in my 20s. But it's not about the age. And that's the thing, the love at first sight thing, if it's true, it doesn't, age isn't that important, right? But it's your connection in the past lives which has led you to that state, to that point where there's that intense interest. repeated connection, repeated concern, repeated care for each other, and then you have that kind of moment. I'm not saying this was love at first sight, right, with this lady that she walked across pedestrian crossing. It was, but it was an amazing experience, and being so young, you just think, okay, it's strange, we'll just keep moving on. I certainly wasn't a Buddhist at that stage, or else I probably would have stopped and just like, right, it's worth 10 minutes just to work out what was going on here, right, just to investigate, right? I wasn't thinking marriage or anything silly like that, right? But just to know, what is this, how is this, how do I know this person? Taking that time, it was a missed opportunity. And I would encourage you not to miss those kinds of opportunities. And it's not necessarily about getting married and living happy ever after and all that kind of, you know, Hansel and Gretel business, right? It's not about that fairy tale stuff, but it's actually like, what kind of connection did you have in the past? Maybe you can learn something from that person. But the same applies to the other end of the spectrum as well, the people who you don't like. And lifetime after lifetime, you cultivate the opposite views, the opposite wisdom, not shared generosity, not the same virtuous behavior. And so that's how you wonder. You ever wonder why somebody comes into the room and you just hate them? I don't know you, but I don't like you. You haven't said anything, but that's enough. It's like, where does that come from? And it's not anything different to what is here. It's just the opposite of that. Right? If it can go one way down the stream, well, then it's also possible it can go the other way, right? It's a two-way street, this business. Love and hate is on the same spectrum. They're just at opposite ends. So when you're in your relationship, whereabouts are you on that spectrum of love and hate? Are you right down the end of love? Or should I say the lust and hate spectrum? Is it real love? Because if it's real love, you don't need to be related to them. They don't need to be a relation. They don't need to be your child. They don't need to be your husband or your wife. If it's true love at first sight means without exception, all-encompassing, everyone, everything, every sentient being. Even if they want to attack you, as the Buddha says in the simile of the saw, even if bandits were to hold you down, limb by limb, and start to saw off one of those limbs. If your mind gives rise to anger, you are not practicing my teaching. How many of you would be happy to have your arm sawed off and test your loving kindness? I'm not. It's not the point. I'm not trying to prove anything, but what it's saying is, even under such duress, if your mind gravitates to that unwholesome state of anger, you're not practicing the teaching of the Buddha. So when we look at our loved ones, we have a certain bias. After all, your family and friends are just strangers. When you're born in this life, they're all strangers to you. You may have known them from a past life, but for all intents and purposes, as a child, you forget your past lives. Most children do. Some remember. But you're not going to remember everyone from every past life, right? So when you encounter people who you like a lot or don't like a lot, reflect upon this. Do I really want that story to keep going? Or can I sit in the middle and let go of both ends of that spectrum? Can I move outside of that spectrum? Because that's where the peace is. Love and hate is a seesaw. If you accept one side of the seesaw, you have to accept the other side. It comes with it. You cannot move one end of that seesaw and the other end doesn't shift. It does. Best is to be off that seesaw. Move towards equanimity. When you sit in that middle point, you don't go to these extremes. This is best. People who sit in the middle of the seesaw, yeah, it's not that much fun, but you're never dumped. Have you ever had that experience, those of you who've had the luxury of a seesaw as a child? You get on the seesaw with another person, oh, it's all great fun, up and down, the jumping and jumping, then one looks over there and says, oh, there's a ball, jumps off. Boom, you're dumb. Does it sound like relationships? Oh, what's that over there? Ooh, something interesting. See ya. Dumped. It's like that. So the problem is, because you've accepted You've accepted that scale of love through to anger. When you accept that kind of scale, sure, you're going to get dumped at some stage. You will also feel happiness as well. Oh yes. But just like the seesaw, does it last forever? One of the two is going to tire at some stage, then you gravitate to the other end. It's this kind of action. Left and right, left and right. But best to move off that seesaw. You'll never get dumped. You'll never have the exhilaration and the excitement, but you'll never get dumped as well. This living with equanimity is like this. Your mind is steady, not shaking. And this is one of those qualities that allows you to see things as they really are. Now the story of John before, he was on the seesaw. Even with his good friend the Dhamma there, developing that close connection, that relationship with the Dhamma, the nature of it changes over time for you. Your understanding of that relationship changes over time. What I first approached is not what I'm approaching now. And that's how you learn. Learning means change. And learning does mean and does involve suffering. Absolutely. Wisdom doesn't come from pleasure. Wisdom comes from challenge and how you approach that challenge. It's not about inflicting challenges unnecessarily on yourself. You know, I'm not asking you go out to the ocean and swim 15 kilometers and see if you can make it back. That's just being silly. But how you take things as they're appearing to you. Do you lose it completely? Are you jumping on the seesaw straight away? Or are you giving it some time, some reflection, some consideration? That is my talk this morning on love at first sight. And I open up for any questions that you may have about that topic or any other topic as you see fit. Yes?
So what do you say to those people that say opposites attract?
Opposites attract. I think that they're into chemistry and physics. North magnet, south magnet, attract. Sometimes that's true. People find within their relationships, they find within themselves an inability to do something. There's a lack or a deficiency. And so then they go and seek somebody who can complement them in that deficiency. In a similar way, when you've sweated a lot, you have salt deficiency, and you'll go and eat and drink salty things in order to re-establish the balance of salts in your body. So in that way, the opposites attract for the balancing outside of things. But in relationships, you don't just get the things that you want. It's a whole package deal. You might get just that little part that you want, and then there's all this other stuff. I didn't want this, just this. Yeah, you were okay until you started being yourself. This is the problem with relationships. We seek certain qualities out, but we don't want to take the other stuff with it, you know? So, yeah, opposites sometimes, yes, they do attract. Probably more so, more regularly than the same-minded people. This is actually quite a rare thing, you know, to find people very, very similar views. Yeah. Okay, I think there was an emailed question to me in regards to this topic. So the statement, I have fallen in love with you, or I don't want or love you anymore, so I want a divorce. Is this love a mixture of carnal desire, friendship, social or religious relationships between two persons? Must there be some spiritual binding or meaning within it? So this idea of falling in love is kind of, it goes back to that question there. Falling in love means there's usually some aspect of another person that you're either deficient in, or you're actually reflecting the quality that you have back to you. So you find a person who is like a mirror to reflect back the good qualities within you, or the things that you like about yourself, and you want to validate your existence. You want to create this concept of self, and the way you do that is who you associate with. What friends are you with? What partner are you with? How do they reflect that back to you? This is what we do. We sell ourselves and we want to be sold on ourselves. because that gives us a reason to keep going. For as soon as you pull the rug out from the idea or the concept, I am, it doesn't matter what the other party reflects. It's not personal anymore. But prior to that, it's personal, deeply personal. You will take it very personally. Whatever they say is a reflection upon you. So when they're saying nice things about you, who doesn't like that, huh? Yay! Bhante Jag's great, yay! Oh, you know, I think you should hang around me more often. Yeah. Bhante Jag, you're a pain in... Nah, come on, that's it, that's enough. I don't want that kind of reflection. And that's what it's like in relationships. We prefer to have people who reflect back the things that we want to hear, right? That's who your friends are, people with shared defilements. You've heard of friends with benefits. That's one thing. But then friends with shared defilements. This is the nature of it, really. Do you like watching movies? Yes. Do you like watching Titanic? No. Okay, you're not my friend. Do you like watching romantic comedies? Yes. Okay, we can hang out. That's what it's like. You've got to have your little checklist. You tick off, you know. What kind of things are you interested in? This? What's your political view? No, that's our friendship's finished. We didn't even start. No. You save yourself a lot of trouble if you do that. Just get a list. You can have it electronically, it's okay. And just hand them the iPad or something and say, can you just do this survey, please, before... Look, I'm a busy person. I've got very limited time to invest. So it's just 60 questions. It covers everything, religion, philosophy, political views, and nature. So if you can just fill, I don't want to waste your time, or vice versa. Yeah. And the last question, do you really like me regardless of what I say or do? If you tick that one, all the rest is invalid. You get in straight away, right? Maybe that's the first question. You tick that box, we're done, okay? It's great. I'm going to always hear what I want to hear. Right? It's fantastic. But most of, well, I haven't heard of any relationships like that, but sometimes they're called prenups. Prenup is the checklist. Are you going to take financial advantage of me? Yes or no? Are you going to try and split everything 60-40? Yes or no? Are you going to take the children and the car? Yes or no? If the relationship fails within 12 months, what happens? Oh my God. I don't even believe in God, but oh my God. People, that's called having your cake, right, and eating it at the same time. I want to have my cake and I want to eat it. But no, you can't have your cake and eat it at the same time. It's either the cake's there or you're eating it. But that's what people want. They want it all. And they don't want to risk anything. Relationships are risky. It's like the seesaw, right? You can play on the seesaw, but if you don't get off at the same time, you don't get off the seesaw at the same time, what's going to happen? Crash. Somebody's going to get dumped, right? They're going to suffer a little bit there, or a lot. Depends on how reckless they are on the seesaw. The more risks you take, the more likely you'll get injuries and suffering. But with that risk and with that suffering also comes the wisdom. I'm not asking you to do a lot of reckless things, okay, as I said before. But you might take some risks, you might suffer a bit, but hopefully you learn from it and don't repeat the same mistakes. Because that's how you develop wisdom. So those kinds of comments, love at first sight, we're kind of kidding ourselves more often than not. That's why when that topic, it was somebody suggested a topic for Valentine's Day. I thought, oh, what do I choose for this? Valentine's Day. I'm not Mr. Fluffy, it's not my territory. So I had to try and spin it somehow. So it's a true story, but just put it in such a way that actually comes back to Dhamma. Okay. All right, are there any other questions? If there aren't any other questions, and I know it's such a topic, now that I've probably poured a lot of cold water over that fire, I've drowned it in a dam of Dhamma, there's probably no more questions to be had. It's like, oh, I want to ask Bhante how I get a good boyfriend. Oh, I've figured that now. He's going to bury it. All right, no more questions. Going once. Going twice. Is that a hand going up or is that playing with the bottle? That's a playing with the bottle, okay. Going three times, soul to silence.